This is an Enterprise Times podcast. My name is Ian Murphy. I'm here with Rob Krause, Security Research and Strategy Director at the NTT Security Global Threat Intelligence Center, to talk about the 2019 Global Threat Intelligence Report.
Hi, Ian, and thank you for inviting me to talk today. I'm a director within our Global Threat Intelligence Center, and as you mentioned, we had recently published our Global Threat Intelligence Report for 2019. This was comprised of all of the information that we've collected over the last year from 2018 observations of different types of attacks that we see impacting many organizations globally. Within NTT Security, I work alongside the other directors on our team who pull the information in, analyze it, produce it, put it into a digestible and hopefully very usable format for our clients. That way they have some sort of view to the rise and fall of different types of attacks that might be impacting their organization.
I see a lot of global reports come across my desk. The challenge with many of them is understanding the base of data on which they are based. You have, of course, the advantage of access to NTT communications and the amount of traffic they carry. Can you give us some idea of what you've based the report on and where your data comes from?
Every year we pull the report together, we have a pretty good view of the different types of attacks, not just based off of volume, but the type of attacks that we observe globally and against our clients in different vertical markets. Our data is based off of over 6 trillion log lines of information that we're pulling in from our clients' networks throughout the year. It's sanitized, there's no sensitive information in it, but we do extract the important information from those. That 6 trillion log lines that we observe and analyze every year, you could think of that as the basis of information for the report. We see billions of attacks, so we start to boil everything down to a more digestible level. As a managed security service provider, our goal is to take all of that information and provide it to our clients in such a manner that it's digestible, it's usable. We really pride ourselves on being able to say, client, if we're going to call you at 2 o'clock in the morning, it's because we've already done all the analysis. But to your point, we have analyzed 18 different sectors or industries ranging from finance to healthcare. We also look at where the attacks are coming from, where our clients are situated globally, and a lot of the findings within the report are based off of that. So we can tell you that specific vertical markets in specific regions we've noticed have been attacked with these types of attacks coming from these other locations. From a tactical and a strategic perspective, could be very valuable to organizations when they're trying to architect their overall security posture, their solution, where they're doing business, and understanding that there are different threats in different regions.
Somebody listening to the podcast and hearing things like trillions of lines of log files, billions of events, millions of attacks, will start to worry that there's something going on that they don't know about. But there's a big difference between the numbers and what eventually becomes actionable intelligence, isn't there? Can you just give us a quick view of how that translates into something that the customer needs to actually deal with?
Exactly. I was a consultant for many years on the front line doing the penetration tests, pointing out where the vulnerabilities are, where the weaknesses are, where they need to shore up their controls. You can look at the report very much in that perspective. If you know that, for instance, in the United States and you're a financial institution and you know that a very significant portion of your attacks as a financial institution, specifically in the United States, are based against web applications, that gives you some information to help you process and apply that towards your risk management program. Evaluate, do I have a situation when it comes to attacks against financial organizations in the United States? What does my web presence look like? What types of attacks are they seeing against web applications in the finance sector in the United States? This helps with the decision-making process. I think you and I can probably agree, Ian, that the security budget is never as lucrative and as deep as it could be. So we have to be very smart with how we're architecting our solutions. And I believe that a lot of reports such as ours helps provide the decision makers the information that they need to spend those dollars in the most effective manner.
So what were the big hits this year off the report?
Well, there were quite a few. Some of the key findings we had is that the finance sector, once again, was in the top attack sectors globally. They were in the top 5, 6 out of the last 7 years. We kind of expect to see that for a couple different reasons. The finance sector specifically has very high quality data. When you're going to a bank or you're opening a new account or you're applying for a mortgage, there's a certain amount of reporting that's required by the financial institutions. They have to ensure that they have high quality data. On top of that, they have a lot of ties to the actual financial transactions. We see many different creative types of attacks against the finance industry from a fraud perspective, and most of those attacks that we're seeing against finance in the United States are against web applications. We attribute that to financial organizations mainly have larger web presences than other companies that are out there. There's a difference between a website serving as a brochure that describes services. When you look at organizations like finance and healthcare, where there's a higher level of interaction expected, that they have more robust applications, larger footprints for their applications. And because of that, from my experience looking at vulnerabilities and performing vulnerability research, the more lines of code that you have in an application, the more opportunities there are to be vulnerabilities. Web application threats won't disappear by any means. Another thing that I found quite interesting in the report, and maybe it's not so much that it's interesting because it's there year after year, but looking at reconnaissance activity. Out of all of our data globally, last year we observed 73% of all the activity was related to reconnaissance type activity. It's the signs of bad things to come. It's the first part of the attack life cycle. You can't attack effectively what you don't know. Just as the military invests a lot of money in reconnaissance capabilities and knowing what our enemies are up to, it's just as important for cyber criminals as well.
We've become pretty immune to recon attacks. Go back 25, 30 years, we all worried about these port scans as a type of recon. But then we've all become educated to think, oh, well, they're a low-level attack, they're done by script kiddies, you don't need to worry, these aren't very clever people. But they're often not just about what they can find out about the inside of my organization, are they?
No. If you really dig down into reconnaissance, what does that mean? For your average network engineer, reconnaissance activity probably means somebody's doing a port scan from China or from other countries. In our report, we show that there's a lot of countries where reconnaissance activity is coming from. The point, though, is 73% of reconnaissance activity is important, but if you're baselining reconnaissance activity against your organization, things like lack of reconnaissance activity can also be just as important. We've seen an increase in reconnaissance activity, and then all of a sudden it drops off and goes quiet than our normal baseline. What does that mean? If you look at the attack life cycle, are they moving on? Are they starting to weaponize? Are they starting to get those exploits ready for the actual attack? So quiet times could actually be worse than normal reconnaissance activity. When we're monitoring our clients, we have baselines that we establish for our clients. We put together monthly report cards. We talk about this is where we saw increases in not just actual attacks, but also reconnaissance activity. Did it hit thresholds that it hasn't hit in the past? Is it below thresholds? Are there concerns with that? I think all of that's important, but also need to understand that there's different types of reconnaissance activity. Is the reconnaissance activity we're seeing specifically within itself shifting? This month, 70% of the reconnaissance activity against my network was my normal observations. 50% of it was related to port scanning type activity, and the remaining was web-based fingerprinting. And if that's my normal baseline, but 2 months from now, I see that's totally changed. I see more attacks coming against my backbone infrastructure. What does that mean? Does that mean those are new and different attackers? Have the attackers said, okay, their web applications are pretty tight, but I still want to break into this company because they have valuable information, so I'm going to switch my focus to network or backbone? Reconnaissance does get written off a lot. When I go into organizations and they say, oh, it's just reconnaissance activity, you kind of laugh a little bit and say, well, what kind of reconnaissance activity is it? Because that is what you're going to see before the major attack comes down the pipe. It's just as important. That's why in the report we highlight that 73% of that reconnaissance activity is what we're observing out of all of our traffic. By design, it's going to be noisy. By design, it's going to take up. 73% doesn't rattle our cages or make us say, wow, that's a lot. We expect it because that's the noisiest part of the attacks. But what you do with that information is important.
There's another interesting thing that spins out of that. As you say, 73%, it's a big number. When we get hit with a DDoS attack or we have a major attack on part of our network, our entire focus then tends to be on this big attack. We're seeing a significant increase in the number of blended attacks going on. let's throw something at the wall, let's have everybody looking at that wall, and then we'll attack from the side or we'll attack from behind. Without the recon, they're first of all not going to know that there are other places they can attack through. But how do we convince the defenders that just running around when a DDoS attack hits and trying to re-establish the network is not necessarily the priority for the business?
That's a good point. One of the key points that we have is that every organization is different. We can have two financial institutions in the same city, the same town, the same street, across the street from each other, but have very different values to attackers. Our customers are different. Our back-end platforms, in many cases, are different. There's different vulnerabilities associated with the types of businesses that we're delivering. In incident and response engagements, we're trained today, as we have been for years, when we see a DDoS attack. You can think about the different flavors of DDoS attack. We have seen them where they were used for geo or political statements, which are pretty straightforward. When it comes to specifically financial, you have to understand that there's different motives behind it in many cases. One of the things we quite often see is where financial institutions will undergo a distributed denial of service attack, volumetric type attack, bandwidth constricting. They'll undergo these DDoS attacks, and sometimes it'll be for a short 10 minutes, sometimes it'll be hours. We've seen in the press where sometimes it'll last for days, but we've been trained to understand that that's just a distraction. It's a feint. It's basically, look over here, IT guy, security guy, go take care of this big volumetric flood that I'm putting at your front door on your website. There's a lot of SQL injection tools that have been used for DDoS attacks in the past, preventing access to web servers. But at the same time, from our experience in incident response engagements that we've been on, within minutes of a DDoS attack starting, you will see usually anywhere from 3 to 5 fraudulent financial transactions taking place on the back end. And what happens is the attackers have set up this very intricate network to where they're taking money from a legitimate account. They're initiating a transfer to another account that is located at a totally separate bank in a totally separate state that has been set up specifically for use as a mule account or another account that was compromised. Quite often, you'll see attackers go through multiple proxies to hit a target. Sometimes when they're exfiltrating money, they will also hop through multiple banks because when it reaches a certain level in the financial transaction stage, there is a point where the bank can't pull the money back. Once it hits a certain point, they can only pull back some of it, but in many cases, not all of it. So there's always some sort of loss. We see similar where spear phishing attacks are popular for that as well. You have to be diligent when you're undergoing an attack. Think about it this way. A fire department has a fire at a house. If they deploy all engines to the house and there's another fire over on the other side of town and they've used all their resources, how do they put out that other fire? It's the same thing when you're dealing with those types of DDoS attacks. The intent is to try to tie up everybody into this one attack so they have nothing to do, no resources to handle the other attack, which is actually the real attack.
We tend to see DDoS as being the most obvious of the distraction attacks because it takes our network down, it blocks people coming to the company. If we look at education, we're seeing a different type of distraction attack, and that's illicit coin mining. We're seeing a lot of people taking advantage of the massive amount of resources that educational establishments can access. But at the same time, educational establishments are finding themselves under a lot of pressure for their commercial work, their activities doing research on behalf of companies, research that might take another 5 years before a company can productize it, but which actually is incredibly valuable. Are you seeing a similar distraction pattern with illicit coin mining and exfiltration of IP from universities?
When it comes to coin mining, that's definitely been the topic of discussion here for the last year or so. We've seen a lot of interesting ways to generate cryptocurrency. What we're seeing specifically in education institutions within the United States, as a matter of fact, it was one of the reasons the education institutions had moved up in our rankings as far as attack sectors was because of illicit coin mining operations. With education specifically, we find that most education institutions are built on the premise of collaboration, sharing. Years ago, education institutions had very flat networks. Students, teachers, infrastructure, all on the same network because it was easier to collaborate. But we find that within the last 5 years specifically that educational organizations are getting a lot smarter when it comes to the architecture of their networks, because at one point it kind of felt like the wild, wild west. There's a lot of things going on and it's hard to control. You want your students to be creative and use as much research and give them as much information and data as they can get their hands on as they're growing their skills, their capability, their knowledge as a student. At the same time, education institutions also need to make sure that their infrastructure is secure. We've seen a couple different categories of coin mining when it comes to education specifically, and we've even mentioned in the report some of them are illicit in nature, where systems have been compromised. They are used specifically to generate cryptocurrency without the knowledge of the user. We've also seen what we call dorm room mining operations. It's where college students are trying to make some extra money. Look at different websites out there today that are taking cryptocurrency as a form of payment, and there's a lot of allure to generating cryptocurrency. For illicit crypto mining to work, in most cases, there had to be some sort of vulnerability or some sort of access that the attacker had utilized to gain access to implement the coin mining activities. There's a lot of sponsored research that's done in academic organizations by major companies globally, not just within the United States. What does that mean for the security of those research projects that are sponsored by other major corporations? You've got illicit crypto mining operations happening within the same network that students are also doing sponsored research for global enterprises. How does that expose potentially proprietary information in those environments to the world, to the bad guys? How does it give the leg up to the attackers, or even from a corporate espionage perspective?
It's an extension of the supply chain attack that we've had, but on a much bigger scale. A lot of organizations are still struggling with their digital transformation and integration of supply chain, both customers and suppliers. But then when you look at universities, their commitment to being open, their commitment to being interconnected, this commercial work, they have far more risk as their point in that supply chain.
When you think about it, corporations have done a little bit better of a job over the last few years with managing vendor risk. I don't want to say we're anywhere near out of the woods. From our experience, the consulting engagements that we work on, we're seeing companies realizing that, hey, it's not about just trusting our network. It's who are we exchanging data with, whether it's through a direct VPN or whether it's just intellectual property that's being developed between organizations and what have you. I think those vendor risk management steps and the vetting is getting a little bit better. The spirit of a large company going to a university and saying, we're going to give you a multi-million dollar grant for your students to come up with the next best X. I think that there's a lot of good intent there, but how does that fall into a risk management, vendor risk management profile? Do corporations go to education institutions? Do they look at them as now a vendor? Or do they say, oh, this is a grant, they're going to help us create a whole bunch of really cool stuff. We don't want to burden them with all the security stuff. We just want to make great things happen. That's definitely something to keep an eye on.
Something else that jumped out at me from the report was this issue of where the attacks come from. Now, as in previous years, the United States and China are the start point for many attacks. One thing that will surprise many is that the Russian Federation only appears to be attacking America and is a bit player when it comes to the launch of attacks. If we look at many of the press releases we see from the industry, they all rush to do attribution. And on these numbers, you'd have large numbers of people saying the United States is eating itself in terms of cybersecurity and Russia's really not a threat in any way, shape or form. These numbers can be incredibly misleading, can't they, if they're read wrongly?
They can. When I'm out doing public presentations, I'll usually start off my conversation right after we talk about the volume of data. I usually take a little sidebar and say, let's talk about sources. When we're talking about the source of attacks, you really have to look at attribution from the perspective of the person who's talking about it and what context they're talking about. For us, when we're talking in the report that we've seen combined with the United States and China, X number percent of attacks overall, that doesn't necessarily always mean that there's a whole bunch of bad guys sitting in the United States or China specifically. We had some reports where I think we had a significant increase in reports from the Seychelles Islands where we had millions of attacks. Does that necessarily mean there's millions of people in the islands that are actually performing those attacks? No. we have to remember when we're talking about attacker TTPs or attack patterns and intrusion sets, quite often the tactic is to proxy through multiple sites. We also know that attackers like to source their attacks from as close to the target as they can. There's a bit of counterintelligence that goes into the way that we look at attack. Years ago, the solution was, well, we don't do business with China, or we don't do business with Russia. If we see any scan traffic coming from Russia, just drop all traffic from Russia or China. Today's in global economy, you can't really do that anymore. We can't just say, take off a large part of the globe and we're not going to accept any traffic from them. So to your point, attribution does become a challenge. We look at it from the perspective in the report, although we see China and U.S. are usually right at the top. Over years, things fluctuate. Russia's a little bit lower this year than previous years. Other countries have stepped up and filled the gap. That's because the types of attacks change. The attackers will leverage different resources in different countries because based off the types of attacks that they want to perform, that has a lot to do with it as well. You look at things such as the size of botnets that are out there and where they may be sourcing from. There's a lot of things that go into attribution when it comes to that from the report. You can't always take it face value.
You mentioned botnets as a source of many of the attacks. How much is that also shifting with introduction of large cloud data centers that are highly connected, have massive amounts of resource, particularly public cloud, where people can just roll up with a stolen credit card, buy a chunk of access and bandwidth, and use that as a kickoff point for an attack?
That's a really good point. You'll notice in this year's report, we do have a lot of statistics around the United States and China, mainly because they're very large countries. They're very well connected. But there's also quite a bit that's coming from EMEA as well. There's specifically some countries within EMEA we found in previous reports and research from a qualitative analysis. And some of our threat researchers have identified where there's chatter about in some regions within Europe, it's a little bit easier for the bad guys to spin up cloud services for attacks. They're not vetted as well as some other regions in the world. So that has a little bit to play with it as well. When we start looking at adopting the cloud, the attackers are certainly not behind us by any means. They are out on the forefront. They have been using software as a service and platform as a service for attacks for many years. I don't know what the going rate is today, but I got a chuckle years ago when I was looking at websites that were selling DDoS capabilities for as little as $10 for 24 hours. You can do up to 3 minutes of attacks for the price of a dinner. When you start looking at the infrastructure put out there for exploit kits, it's kind of interesting because they really have it down to a business science. We have these exploit kits that are kept up to date. For an additional fee, we will set up your exploit kit for you on your site of choice. And if your site of choice gets compromised, we will move your exploit kit for you to this other place for a small fee. And small fee, I mean literally as little as $10. The metrics that are within those as well, what is successful, what is not. There's a lot of cloud adoption and use of hosting providers has certainly been something that the attackers have leveraged. It's not just for legitimate day-to-day corporate business. It's definitely anything that can be used for good can also be used for bad.
Phishing's one of these attacks that just won't go away. What's more worrying is despite the amount of effort we've put into education around phishing, it is getting more and more successful. And the attackers are getting smarter. I'm coming across attacks where they are perfectly replicating websites. It's only experience and maybe a little paranoia that a couple of times have stopped me almost clicking on something, taking a step back and a deeper look. How do we begin to improve users' understanding of the risk from phishing attacks? But more importantly, how do we start to detune them as a major source of attack?
There's a blend that's always needed with many things in security, not just cybersecurity, but all things in general. Education and training employees is probably the most cost-effective thing you can attempt to do, but it's also not the most widely successful. And I'll be clear here, training your employees to identify and understand threats is still very important. I think we've done a better job in the last couple of years, specifically extending that to saying, and this is how we make it easy for you to report a potential phishing attack in this case. But we can't rest our laurels on just training and education, because there's always a part of the population where people don't care, they don't understand, they just go through the training to get through with the training. Your mileage is going to vary. Every one of us, just like every company is different, every human is different. That's why we have people that are visual learners. We have people that learn a lot more by reading a book as opposed to putting hands on, and vice versa. There's no training solution that's ever going to prevent that. We try to reinforce the importance of that because we certainly don't want to send the message that training is bad, because it's not. The challenge of fishing in particular is making sure not only that you train your employees, but you have the capability for the employees to leverage that training and report suspected incidents, which I don't see a lot of organizations doing. I see a lot of organizations who will publish a policy and say this is what you should do if you suspect it, but a lot of people don't understand how to actually move forward with the reporting part of that, so that's a big challenge. We understand that people will not always absorb 100% or not pay attention to training, or, like you said, attacks are just getting craftier. We have to also implement detection capabilities for different types of phishing. With our MSS services, we have capabilities where we can identify things that are definitely awry or suspicious and identify phishing. And that's where a lot of our things that we talked about in the report had come from. But you need to balance that. You have to always assume that somebody's going to click on the link. Like you mentioned, there's been times where I received emails and I'm like, hey, yeah, I do use this service. It's not that the attacker knew that I used the service, or maybe they did. Maybe they did a really good job fingerprinting who Rob Krause is. They went with the spear phishing attack. There's so many different services. If you look at the phishing targets from this year, they were targeting primarily Microsoft 365. There's a huge population that's using that, and some of the other services that are out there. So you have to figure out how you balance the training, the education, the processes to notify if you suspect that it's a phishing email, but also the technical controls, because you can't trust that people are always going to either, one, do the right thing, or two, try to do the right thing, but it slipped by. I go back to looking at this from a risk perspective. Organizations, before they start throwing a whole bunch of money on solutions that will prevent phishing attacks, they need to look at really what that threat is to their organization, which is one of the points we try to make in our report about architecting your solution to meet your needs. With phishing in particular, you have to make sure that you have the proper training, the proper education, but also the technical controls, because you know somebody is going to click the link anyway. So you need to have some additional technical capabilities in place to help you with that.
Generic phishing attacks come out of the blue. They're just a broad blast spam email with an attempt to get you to do something. The rise in spear phishing attacks, where they've spent the time to understand the target, maybe through the amount of information people put out on social media. It may have come through credential breaches in places. Those are the more dangerous attacks that we see inside organizations at the moment. What are you seeing in terms of an increase in spear phishing as opposed to generic attacks?
With spear phishing, this gets back to attribution context. The first thing to know if it's a spear phish is how much level of detail you have about the target. Most of the time when we're performing spear phishing type investigations, it is usually related to incident response engagements with our customers. That's actually where you start to see a lot of really interesting things happening. I do not have statistics for this year's report, but in previous reports, it was highly targeted against financial institutions or the financial department within institutions. Most of the time, the spear phishing attacks that we've observed really have to do with specifically targeting the relationship between the accounting department and the C-suite. And as you can imagine, there's been no shortage of these discussions and write-ups and white papers, but it usually goes something like, accounting department receives a spoofed email, the CEO saying, we need to pay this immediately. The accounting department says, oh, I don't want to make the CEO mad. We're going to go ahead and process this and have that happen. We've seen a lot more advanced attacks where there's multiple stages to it. They'll target the CEO specifically and say, hey, your company owes me money. They haven't paid me yet. Who do I talk to in your accounting department? And then that whole email chain evolves, even to the point where the attacker will call up the person in the accounting department and say, we need payment by 5 o'clock today, or we're going to stop our services to you. If you look at phishing and spear phishing, depending on the level and the depth of spear phishing you're looking at, it also gets interesting from the metadata or just the collection of information. If, for instance, I am a consumer who has a website that I go to that sells widgets, and I buy widgets all the time. I love widgets for the sake of this conversation. The widget company gets compromised. There's a public disclosure of the database. If I'm an attacker looking at this, I'm saying, who's on the widget database? Not because necessarily I just want to reuse their credentials, but that's a perfect list of people for me to go after for a spear phishing attack. I know Rob loves widgets. He likes blue ones. He likes green ones. Let's put the green ones on sale and send Rob a phishing email. But you could imagine doing that to a whole database of customers in one shot. I have to believe that your phishing is going to be a lot more lucrative as a bad guy. It's no different than targeted advertisements when you're looking at a web browser. I was looking at new windows last week for my house, and all of a sudden I've got all these pop-ups saying, hey, buy these windows. They're on sale.
It would be very easy for somebody looking at the report to look at this and think, wow, there's a lot in here. How do I digest it? What are the top things people need to think about taking away?
There are plenty of great reports that are out there today, and a lot of them have different unique angles on the data that's within the report. Organizations will use certain reports for certain reasons, because it aligns better with their vertical or it aligns better with their ideology of their security programs. One of the things is, don't become paralyzed by the numbers. Even within our report, we show a lot of really interesting things that would hopefully help organizations understand the types of attacks and where they're coming from and what have you. But you can't just get hung up on the numbers in particular. You really need to take a look at who your organization is, what they are today. Do they have specific goals in mind as far as their security programs? How do you architect what perfect security is for your organization? There is no such thing as 100% security anywhere. But what is your use case? What is that perfect security for your organization? Like we mentioned earlier, you really need to look at the uniqueness of your organization, what your tolerance for threats are, what your threshold is for your appetite for risk. And you need to design to that. You need to understand that if you don't have a goal, you're never going to achieve it. It's like I tell the guys on my team, and I even tell this to my kids, if you don't put a date on the calendar to get something done, most of the time you won't. You have to have a goal to shoot for. I think number one is making sure that you architect what your solution looks like, but architect it to where it's flexible enough to where you can change it if you need, because business changes day to day. Another point is governance, risk, and compliance. If you look at some of the regulations and compliance initiatives that have come up, not just in the United States, globally, there's a lot of discussions, a lot of it specifically related to privacy these days. It's not going away. And I tell people this, a lot of times you'll get the feedback that this compliance thing, it's dragging me down, it's costing me all this money. Kind of tongue-in-cheek, most of the things in regulations and compliance, when you look at them, some of the initiatives that are out there, I'm not going to mention one in particular because there are a lot of really good ones, but most of them are doing and telling you to do things that you probably should be doing already from a cybersecurity perspective. Most of the time, it's not bad advice. Make sure when you're looking at GRC to embrace it, realize that your organization needs to satisfy it to be in compliance with the different regulations and what have you. But the ones that are going to be most successful are the ones that are going to lean into it and embrace it. When I say embrace, I don't necessarily mean it's going to be fun, but get a handle of it earlier, understand what it means to you and your clients, and in the long term, hopefully those compliance and risk initiatives will strengthen your organization. Probably the last point, just from a consultative perspective, I'll tell this quick story that I was at lunch one day with a C-level executive at CISO, and we were just talking about different strategies for a nice, relaxing lunch, and he turned to me at one point and he said, you know what, my friend had recommended this web application firewall. He's heard about really great success with it and how great it is with stopping threats, and he said, what do you think? I said, well, you know what, we've heard a lot of great things about that company. But what makes you think that you need a web application firewall to begin with? And he kind of looked at me confused. And I said, well, think about it this way. Have you had a risk assessment recently? What was your most recent risk assessment? Where is your greatest loss potential for your company? Is it even anything related? It turns out that after further conversation that they had larger loss potential from DDoS. He had a light bulb moment to where it was, yeah, why am I looking at purchasing a WAF based off of her friend's recommendation as opposed to really understanding what my organization needs? That's my last point. Managing by risk, understanding the threats, understanding what your appetite is, understanding what potential loss exposure you have, are all part of the equation. we have to get away as a security industry from the there's an app for that mindset. Just because we see some reconnaissance activity against your web server does not necessarily mean you need to go out and spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on a WAF, where you could better, as we mentioned earlier, use your very tight budget to actually put it in the places that make bigger difference for your company. That's my parting guidance. Understand the risks, understand what your appetite is, and be very judicious when it comes to how you spend your company's money, because budgets change from year to year, and sometimes it's hard to keep up with the threats and address them.
Rob, thank you for your time today.
Thank you.